Well, welcome back to this third in the American Cassette Ministry Seminar. And the topic for this session will be Eternal Rome. And I hope the subject won't be my papers falling, so I'll put them over here. Where do you start talking about Rome? For Seventh-day Adventists, this is a topic that resonates a lot with our historical understandings. And very often, until quite recently, I think, our evangelistic outreach dealt a lot with the role of Rome. But there's many things when you're talking about Rome. You know, I'm inclined toward poetry. And last night, as I was thinking about what to say this morning, I was reminded of a long poem by Lord Byron. Probably not too Americans, many Americans read it. You don't study British literature the same way, but Lord Gordon, Byron, had a poem called Manfred, and in there he had the fellow visiting the ancient city of Rome, Imperial Rome, or seeing the remainders of it, and he said, at midnight there he saw those ruined columns and the aqueducts and so on, and he says, and he was filled up with the sense of the grandeur of the ages, until he said the place became religion. Well, it's a nice figure of speech for a poem, but in reality, that's exactly what happened. We know that the early Christian church that was so persecuted by Rome actually morphed into that great central power of Rome, and then when Rome itself collapsed, Christianity was left as a pseudo-religious or pseudo-political power. I've mentioned earlier, when I was younger, doing different things, and I do remember going to Rome as a teenager in St. Peter's there. They had one of the, I think it's the weekly masses that the Pope puts on, but wasn't the present Pope, it was about two or three back now. But to see him brought in on a litter, swaying under the different functionaries that were carrying him aloft there, and the blinding flash of the press cameras going off, and the adulation of the crowd, it's something, again, as Ellen White said, that the pomp and circumstance and just the whole context of this worship of Romanism, it does attract people. It's something that it has going for it. Back to Daniel 2, you know, this power that's represented by the iron. In many ways, we're still living in the after effects of the Roman Empire. You only can really understand Europe if you hark back to Rome and how it ruled the known world. And curiously enough, and Adventists seem unaware of it, the reformulation of a united Europe in some ways is an attempt to bring back together what used to be known as the Holy Roman Empire, the states that were under the direct control of Rome that formed that rump Imperial Rome. There's probably no better anecdote that I can give you, though, to tell where we are today and what Rome represents, than to tell you something that I saw probably 17, 18 years ago now. I was back in Australia, in the US after being in Australia for some years, and watching on public television, I saw live proceedings, probably time delay, but they'd filmed live proceedings at the Parliament of Europe. And the Pope of Rome, the present Pope, was addressing the Parliament of Europe. Interesting legislative body. It has a lot more power now than it had back then, but already at that time, most of the major nations of Europe, old Europe, as was famously derided at the beginning of the Gulf War, you know, they were uniting together. They were in the process of giving over their power to the centralized body. They had just chosen their symbol, which still exists. Symbol of the reunified Europe is the Tower of Babel, which sort of brings danger signs for a Christian or anyone who knows the Old Testament story of the Tower of Babel. And they were in the process of casting about for a head of state, which they have not yet chosen. There's just a rotating chairmanship, basically, for the parliament or presidency. I forget the term of the leader, but they certainly don't have any head of state per se. But among the names at the time that were being noised around was the Pope of Rome. And he was there on this occasion to address them. And it was very, very interesting to me. It was a large building that sloped down toward the lectern, and it was a little higher at the back. There were doors all across the back. And the Pope was addressing them in German, as I remember. It certainly wasn't English, but there were translators on the live broadcast humming along, saying what he was saying, and in awed tones describing this and that and the other. In the middle of his address, the back door was smashed open, and a group of demonstrators surged in, put a banner up on the back wall, and I pretty much know what it said, but it was almost secondary to what happened next. Their leader, who I recognized as Ian Paisley, a firebrand Protestant minister from Northern Ireland, stepped three or four steps ahead of them and went down into this position, pointed at the Pope, and he says, "That man is the Antichrist." And as the Pope, as any speaker, I mean, I don't want to impugn too much to his reaction, but he was affronted. He looked, stopped, and he just looked daggers at him. That was shocking enough, and the guards instantly dragged these people out. And dragged is not an overstatement, just unceremoniously out. The commentators were affronted. They said, "What an insult that this moral leader of the free world, this man of peace," they went on and on, "that he should be subjected to such a thing." What was he subjected to? It was a very bad form, I believe. I'm not sure anyone's called to disrupt meetings that way. So the protocol was wrong. But the message was on message for Protestantism. And it had become so aberrant, so out of sync with reality. And as I watched that, I believed, I saw a definitive sign that Protestantism was passé, that it was no longer acceptable to say such things. And you know, that was years ago, and I've spoken about it many times since. But in case that lesson was lost on anyone, in the election of 2000, remember, now President Bush spoke at Bob Jones University, and there was an attempt made to embarrass him politically by Senator McCain, and I don't think any of the politicians had much theological understanding other than just seeing an opportunity to embarrass. I'm sure the president was there because there was an audience, and I'm sure McCain didn't care who or what, but his handlers saw an opportunity. So they criticized the president for speaking at an institution that held vicious anti-Catholic views. And indeed, Bob Jones did and does hold rather old form Protestant views of the role of the papacy and so on. And it was amazing what followed from that that exchange. I remember John Leo writing in U.S. News and World Report said that the views held by Bob Jones University are truly marginal. That's an amazing comment. Probably true, though, but an amazing comment. Truly marginal. That essentially no one believes such things anymore. Chuck Colson defended Bob Jones very nicely in the New York Times paper a few days later, and he invoked the First Amendment and the freedom of speech, all very good defenses. And then he said something very interesting. He said, "In truth, the gulf between Catholics and Protestants, opened by the Reformation, has been bridged, and today we stand as the largest single religious and political bloc in America." And every Seventh-day Adventist should have put up their ears and immediately paid attention. It was almost as though he were quoting Ellen White. Remember, she says, "The Protestants of America will be foremost in stretching their hands across the Gulf to Rome," and then she goes on further about spiritualism. Interesting. We are in a change dynamic, prophetically predicted resurgence of Rome, something that clearly could not have been predicted too long ago. The time Ellen White wrote, remember, what was it, in 1798, General Berthier, the French general, had taken the Pope prisoner. They'd stripped him of all of his powers, essentially. And it was not till the Lateran Treaty with Mussolini, that at least a little property was given back to Rome. In the modern era, Rome has been disempowered in a way that is amazing. And yet in the last few decades, it has come back in a way that is only understood as you look at prophecy. Ellen White makes a lot of statements about Rome that derive from our understandings of prophetic outlines in Revelation most particularly. And she says that the statement will be put out that Rome has changed. Rome has changed. And I must admit to you that there are even people I deal with that sometimes claim as much. There have been some Seventh-day Adventists that I've heard in the last year or two that say that the scenario that Ellen White explained that derives directly from Revelation as well as a Protestant view, forget Adventism, the Reformation view of the role of the papacy, first enunciated by Martin Luther, that the role of the papacy is really fulfilling that of the man of sin, that he's fulfilling a role of an antichrist figure. You know, some Adventists have said that, you know, well, she said that and Protestants held that, but the end time scenario that was given to Seventh-day Adventists was predicated on Christ coming before this. And I'm sure there was that expectation. And since he has not come in this time frame, we're into a new model, a new paradigm now. There's been a paradigm shift. And that in this new scenario, the natural ally of natural allies really are Protestants and Catholics, and our common enemy is secularism. So we will be allied with them in the final battle against secularists. And I remember a good friend of mine who has some contacts with the Vatican. After a conversation I had with him, I guess he wanted to test out what we were saying. He met with some officials in the Vatican, and he asked one of the cardinals. He said, "Do you think that Rome could ever become a persecuting power again?" And the good cardinal thought. He didn't just reflexly shoot anything back. And he thought for a minute, and he says, no, I don't think it's possible. Well, we shall see, I guess. We'll see. But let's see what has happened lately. As far as the Reformation ending, there's been a lot of things that you could point out as being quite definitive. I think one that is pretty hard to beat, and for those that are here, you get to see it on tape. It's just words, but here's a picture of a Roman Catholic prelate. I'm not showing you the picture very well. Shaking hands with a Lutheran leader. It says, "On earth, peace." This was 1999, I think it was, the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church kissed and made up and decided between the two of them that Luther's original argument with the Catholic Church and his original position that we're saved by faith or grace alone, not by works, not by what the Church could offer, not by its being a mediator, all of this was a false system. He was referring straight back to the Bible. It's been decided now between these two entities that this was just a misunderstanding. And in case you misunderstand, there are two images that pretty much explain what's happening. First of all, the testimony here of the Reverend Paul T. McCain from the Missouri Synod, of course they didn't quite agree with this. He says, "The Roman Catholic Church continues to affirm the heresies that were made official church dogma during the 16th century Council of Trent." And he says, here is one example. "If anyone says that justifying faith is nothing else than trust in divine mercy, which remits sins for Christ's sake, or that it is this trust alone by which we are justified, let him be anathema." And the newest edition of the Roman Catholic Catechism, he said, states, "We can merit for ourselves and for others the graces needed to attain eternal life." But the greatest evidence, I think, is found again, visually. That's a picture that says almost everything. There is a Catholic cardinal hammering the agreement to the door of a Catholic basilica. Incredible, incredible. The Reformation is over. And I remember going back a few decades now when the present Pope first visited the United States. As was his developed custom, he's older, too old to do it now, but he knelt and kissed the ground. And the headlines that I saw in this country said, "The Reformation is over." So something has come to an end. I've been very taken in the current election season, which we're now building up toward for the re-election or re-election of the president or his replacement at the end of this year. The Catholic Church is starting to growl about its need to have some power. It was rather a turning point a few decades ago when President Kennedy became the first Catholic president of this country. And he was a great president. There's no demeaning what he did at all. But for Protestants, who were still extant at that time, it was a problematic development. They saw the potential for a revived Roman Catholic Church to influence policy and the president himself in a country that had been designed to support the Protestant concept, not Protestantism per se, but to protect religion in a country that was freed from the constraints of the old church. And Kennedy kept his distance. But let me read you a few quotes here that are very interesting. Catholic bishops and priests are becoming more willing to be more active politically the way Protestant evangelicals are, said this public radio reporter. I think that religion is playing a larger and larger role in politics. That's Mara Leeson. I should know her name because I listen to her all the time on public radio, August 6, 2001. Here's the statement you may have heard. It was in the Wall Street Journal. Last year, George W. Bush ran for president of the U.S. This year, it sometimes seems he's running for president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Mr. Bush had been in office only a few days when he called on the new Archbishop of Washington. Since then, he has visited bishops from Miami, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, New York, and St. Louis. Next week, he sees Pope John Paul II in Rome. That was in July 18, 2001. And here's the kicker. This appeared also in 2001. It says, in 1960, John Kennedy went from Washington down to Texas to assure Protestant preachers that he would not obey the Pope. In 2001, George Bush came from Texas up to Washington to assure a group of Catholic bishops that he would. And that was April 16, 2001. That was in the Washington Post. Washington Post again. They said President Bush and top advisors have been assiduously cultivating Roman Catholic voters in an attempt to realign a once Democratic constituency in much the same way that the Republican Party in the 70s and 80s won over Southern evangelical Protestants. Bush has met privately with at least three high Catholic Church officials and adopted Catholic themes and speeches. His staff has instituted a weekly conference call with an informal group of Catholic advisors, and the Republican National Committee is setting up a Catholic task force. Interesting. This is not wrong, and it would be certainly wrong of me or our church to say that the president can't consult with whoever he wants, that he should not be responsive to blocs, but it is prophetically significant that in a country that had such great sensitivity to the Protestant position, that now it could have turned on its head where there's an extra special effort to accommodate the political needs of the Catholic Church. Something has happened. And remember I quoted Chuck Colson. He gave his you know, the political reason for the shift, but he didn't tell the whole story because he had played a leading role in politically or bringing together the political factions of Catholicism and Protestantism. And they are indeed more and more one single block. And more is being seen what Ellen White says, that when the Protestant churches uniting, she says, on such points of doctrine as are held by them in common, shall, in fact, let me try to give you the quote. She says, when the Protestant churches of the United States, uniting on such points of doctrine as are held by them in common, shall move upon the state to enact their to support their institutions and enact their decrees, then Protestant America will have formed an image to the Roman hierarchy. So the methods are very similar. The fear is not there. In fact, let me give you another quote. This was in the New York Times Sunday magazine of January 2000. Jeffrey Rosen, wrote this. First sentence. He says, whatever else it accomplishes, the election of 2000 will go down in history as the point in American politics when the wall of separation between church and state began to collapse. And his next sentence, which I haven't memorized as well, is he says, and a large reason for that collapse is to be found in the shift between Catholics and Protestants. Something has changed. I remember being very interested to go back read some of the documents in the early days of this republic. And one of the more amazing finds that I made was to read in the letters between Thomas Jefferson and President Adams their discussion of many things, including what would be the future of religion in this country. Now, these were the early presidents. In fact, they both died on the same day, 50 years after the founding of the republic. Thomas Jefferson didn't think religion would survive, which is no surprise. Adams thought it would, but he said this. He says, but for it to survive, first of all, that Hindu Kabbalistic system called Roman Catholicism, and these are his words, not mine, interesting pejorative terms he applied to it, he says, must pass away. But he says, at present, it has a mortal wound. Such is the force of its power, he says, that it may take 200 years for it to disappear. Well, we're 200 years later and it hasn't disappeared. But the mortal wound concept clearly was a Protestant view that he was enunciating. That was the standard view. And there were some quite pejorative statements from early leaders and religious and secular leaders in this country where they were fearful of popery. And you can't defend the sentiments behind them. There was no question. There was a paranoia. There was even an antagonism. And George Washington had to caution Benedict Arnold at one point that we should not harass the papists because they needed their support. But the facts are, and I'm trying to make the point, that this country was unanimous in the early days in seeing the Catholic influence as a mortal threat to the Protestant nature and aims of this country. And it's very interesting that Ellen White, in commenting on this country, which in Revelation 13 is described as a lamb-like beast with two horns, Ellen White says that the two horns are republicanism and Protestantism. So the very nature of this country as it was founded was on Protestant principles. So naturally, the Catholic Church Roman Catholic Church represented the threat of the old world that they had escaped. And the laws and procedures of this country were very consciously designed to keep that at bay. But that has changed. And as I'll say probably the next session, I'll explain in more detail in the next session, the battle really has rapidly devolved down into Catholics and Protestants opposed to secularists. And goodness knows, there are reasons to oppose some of the secularist agenda. But perhaps there is a greater enemy to be discovered in the political aspirations of this common group that will match very nicely what the Catholic Church was wont to do in the Middle Ages. There are many evidences of change, but remember, as I said, Ellen White says she'll cover with apologies, this and that and the other, but she is unchanged, she is the same. But I thought that I couldn't do much better than to go over some of the documents that you may have heard about of late and really look what's going on. Most Seventh-day Adventists are well aware. In 1998, the Catholic Church came out with a document called Dies Domini, the Lord's Day. I've been surprised at how few Seventh-day Adventists have ever seen the document. And you can download it from the Vatican website. A little hard to find nowadays, buried in among other stuff. But it's a long document, 30-some pages. And what is amazing to me is how it hijacks, in essence, our doctrinal understandings of Sabbath and applies them to Sunday, as you would expect, but the way it was done was amazing. Like, for instance, on page 5 of this 34-page document, it says here, God blessed the seventh day and made it holy. We certainly would hold that up as defining the seventh-day Sabbath. And it says, the Sabbath precept, which in the first covenant prepares for the Sunday of the new and eternal covenant, is therefore rooted in the depths of God's plan. They're subverting the very plain biblical truth, but it's not as simple as what we were prepared to tackle, where they say the church authority did it. Now it's given a theological spin, a spin that many Adventists will find hard to resist, because many of us have already bought into this paradigm shift from New Testament to Old Testament. Like, we're under the new covenant. There's a new covenant, all right, but it didn't do away with the prescriptions of the old in the sense of the elements of salvation. The law was not done away with. And he says, this is why, unlike many other precepts, it is set within the context, not set within the context of strictly cultic stipulations. You understand what they're saying now? If we insist on Sabbath, we are cultic. But within the Decalogue, the 10 words which represent the very pillars of the moral life. Amazing. And just one other quote, or two other quotes, but one I'll read to you from this document. It says, it was on the Sabbath that the Jewish people had to gather in the synagogue and rest in the way prescribed by the law. The apostles, and in particular St. Paul, continued initially to attend the synagogue so that there they might proclaim Jesus Christ. Soon, however, the 2 days began to be distinguished ever more clearly in reaction chiefly to the insistence of those Christians whose origins in Judaism made them inclined to maintain the obligation of the old law. It says, in the weekly cycle, however, it is the eighth day after the seventh, that is after the Sabbath, and the first day of the week. The distinction of Sunday from the Jewish Sabbath grew ever more stronger in the mind of the church. And even though there have been times in history when, because the obligation of Sunday rest was so emphasized, the Lord's Day tended to become more like the Sabbath. Moreover, there have always been groups within Christianity which observe both the Sabbath and Sunday as two brother days. So you've been co-opted into agreeing that, yes, they're two brother days. And then at the end, if you look closely, and I didn't bring the page with me today, but it says, while the early Christian church had no particular command from the Lord, they felt they had the authority to change that day. And that's where the penny drops. But for the world at large, this is a wonderfully persuasive document and argument for keeping the first day Sabbath as the true veneration of the seventh day Sabbath, a neat end run, and something that was predicted in this very part and parcel of the role of this usurping religious power. It will think to change times and seasons. And it's happening before our eyes, restated in our age, I believe, in preparation for Sunday observance. And there were many articles at that time, many, many articles in religious and secular press. And there continue to be a low agitation for Sunday observance. I don't expect, as I said before, that we will see much advance activity on the legislative front. I think it's the type of argument that has taken root. It's the operative assumption with the Christian right and the developing Christian nation concept that is developing in the United States. It's part and parcel of that when it comes to power, naturally they will want to legislate some sort of respect and observance for Sunday. Amazing. And at the same time, we should be aware, and if I want to scare you, I can easily do it by telling you about an organization that is still very much active in the religious right called Christian Reconstructionists. You know, you might think we're just dealing with Iranian fundamentalists and other Islamic states that want to establish something like the Taliban's rule in Afghanistan, where rigid and ancient medieval laws are applied, where people's arms are cut off and heads are cut off for adultery and arms for stealing and so on. We have our own form here with the Christian Reconstructionists. And when Christianity Today featured this group some years ago, they profess to be affronted and frightened at their agenda, which includes when they take over this country, which I don't think they will do in their own right, but when they take over on their plans to have an Old Testament system run in Christian America, there will be a 6-month cooling off period, and after that it will be mandatory death for adultery and Sabbath breaking. And you know what they mean by Sabbath breaking. It's unless you keep Sunday, mandatory death. And you could pass them off as just a fanatical, crazy organization if you like, but I was quite startled to notice on at least 2 or 3 occasions during the election of 2000 that the chief ideologue of the Christian Reconstructionist, Gary North, was quoted by name as being in the inner circle of the Bush entourage. Interesting. So these people are not gaining power, but they have some credibility. And when a national calamity or an emergency of a religious nature strikes, we will likely see full-blown a cry to obey the Sabbath of the Christian church and the Sabbath championed by the historic leader of the church that has now been reinstated in such an overt way with its agreement with Lutheranism and its political confederacy with American Protestantism. What other documents are there? There's another one that hardly anyone seems to have made much of, and it troubled me when I saw it. It's called Ad Tuendum Fidem, In Defense of the Faith. It's exactly what it purports to be. It's an outline of only 4 or 5 pages of how the Catholic Church will deal with disciplinary proceedings, mostly against theologians. But at the end, and it came out at about the same time, put out by the office of the Holy Inquisition. And at the end it says, after specifying how the faithful are to be dealt with and the theologians are to be dealt with, it says, whoever denies a truth which must be believed with divine and Catholic faith, or who calls into doubt, or who totally repudiates the Christian faith and does not retract after having been legitimately warned, is to be punished as a heretic or an apostate with a major excommunication. And it says, in addition to these cases, whoever obstinately rejects the teaching that the Roman Pontiff or the College of Bishops, exercising the authentic magisterium, have set forth to be held definitively, or who affirms that they have what they have condemned as erroneous and does not retract after having been legitimately warned, is to be punished with an appropriate penalty. That's shades of the Middle Ages. You don't have to read too deeply into the Middle Ages to know that it rarely was the Catholic Church that actually punished. They had a hand-in-glove relationship with the state, and they threw those signals. They are anathematized, cast into utter darkness. The church has removed its protection from someone that rejects their teachings. And I don't think it's connecting disparate dots to show here the church puts up its new Sabbath and embeds within the Dies Domini document saying that they should work for legislation to support this. It's not an improper suggestion, but it's a very telling suggestion at this point in time. For the church that once was glad to use the power of the state to send people to the rack and the dungeon over not keeping Sunday, is now calling on the faithful to legislate it and then specifying that if you disobey the magisterium, which is code language for the inner sanctum of the infallible Catholic Church, and I'll explain a little further what that means in one of their other documents. We are at a crossroads. And in case you might wonder, why don't you talk to Senator Patrick Leahy, talk to Senator Kennedy, talk to Senator Kerry. Those men and others have been publicly vilified. They are Catholic legislators. They have been vilified of late by major advertising put out with the support of church leadership, which says that the sacrament should be denied for all Catholic theologians who do not do the biddings of the church. They are playing hardball now. And, you know, I've spoken to some of my peers in religious liberty and they'll say, fine, you know, this is reasonable. A church has a right to say that to its members, and maybe they do. But it's significant that the church that has played hardball in the past and at the time of Kennedy and other times says that, well, you know, we're not a threat to this Protestant republic here. Now, there's no pretense about it. We demand, they're saying, that the children of the church in these legislative positions enact
the decrees of the church. There's a boldness here, and it's coming into power again. I was talking and talk about boldness, another document that actually caused a lot of agitation a year or two ago when it came out. It's called Dominus Iesus, on the unicity and salvific universality of Jesus Christ and the church. And I was going to quote a bit from it, but maybe the best thing is to quote the way the BBC News took this. They say, the Vatican has decreed that Catholic theologians and commentators must stop calling Protestant churches sister churches. It says, this was again from Cardinal Ratzinger, and it says that you cannot properly talk of separated churches as churches at all. And then in case groups like Adventists are in any doubts, I'll read at the end what it says there. It says, there exists only a single Church of Christ which subsists in the Catholic Church. On the other hand, the ecclesial communities which have not preserved the valid episcopate and the genuine integral substance of the Eucharistic mystery are not churches in the proper sense. That really created some problems for the ecumenical movement, let me tell you. But they've gotten over it. They saw it as a speed bump in retrospect. But at the time it was, horrors. Here, all that we thought about commonality and mutual respect goes out the window, because at the end of the day there is only one church, one magisterium. The document that I think is probably the most newsworthy and yet the most problematic, you've read about in different ways, not realizing that it was based on a document. The Pope traveled to the Middle East and he apologized for the treatment of the Jews. Let's think what else he apologized. Apologized for the Inquisitions. He apologized for the Crusades. He apologized a little later for the sack of Constantinople. I think that's covered the major apologies. That got good press. Good press. It all comes from a document called Memory and Reconciliation, again written by the Office of the Inquisition, Cardinal Ratzinger. And I read that document, pulled it off the Vatican page, and it will make your theological hair curl. Because first of all, what it says right up front, actually echoing something that Ellen White says in Great Controversy, it says, as it begins its so-called apology, it says, but however, it says, can guilt really be assigned to the actions of another age? In other words, it's changed. You know, the Catholic Church is not the same now, and you know, who knows? But anyhow, it slides over that. Then at the end, it gets into the most interesting analogy and figure that is very telling. It says, just as, this is a very close paraphrase, just as Christ, holy and undefiled, incapable of sin, took upon himself the sins of fallen men to redeem them, so the church, the magisterium of the church, they use the word magisterium, holy and undefiled and incapable of error, will apologize for sinful fallen beings who may have done certain things. That is no apology. That's the best analogy I can think of is we have a soldier that may have smashed someone's head in or paraded a naked prisoner through the streets, and we say, but you know, that's not an American. Well, that may not be representative of what we think there to be, but that was. But this document is designed calculatedly to say these were people that may have done these things, but not the church. It was not the church. It just was someone at some time or place. And again, we can't really assign guilt to them anyhow. There's a different norm there. But to show that we have a redemptive role, we offer an apology. To me, that is not an apology. And again, very telling, in the Catholic Register, which I get every week, at the time of this apology, there was an amazing article defending the Inquisition. And the editor said that it's not really right to condemn the Inquisition, that in reality it was the fairest and most benign court available at the time, and that many prisoners used to try to have their cases transferred to the Inquisition because they would get better treatment for it. To me, it's not worth much historical rebuttal, but it's very indicative of the excuse making that's going on. But to get the ends, to put everything behind them, there's this sort of, we're sorry for it, so now it's off the table. That's really what it means. And I think in the interest of continuing the Protestant identity, we have to explain that you can't so easily dismiss things that were done as a natural extension to the claims and theology of such an organization. Another document that I found very interesting was put out again by the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the Holy Inquisition, with a commentary by the Grand Inquisitor, was the Message of Fatima. And I can remember when the Pope was nearly killed, the scuttlebutt that, you know, news media all around the world put out that he had been about to hear a message of Fatima and before he was killed, and before he was nearly killed, and after he survived, he became convinced that this message applied to him, not to some future event. That has now shown to be true. Very clearly, unambiguously, the cardinal says that this was so, and that the Pope looked at this document that was given in 1917, it was sealed from 1941 to 44, around that era, and had briefly been opened in 1981, now is sort of the operating manual for this president pontificate. And I'll explain what this secret message was. It's amazing. To me, it's like the anti-three angels message. You know, we have these three angels that call out, fear God and give him glory, the God that created everything. Come out of Babylon, basically, lest you share in her sins. Three messages. On the message of Fatima, what was shown was, Lucia, the last surviving of these three girls that was shown this vision, so-called, from the Virgin Mary. She was shown a ruined city, obviously something like World War II, and the Holy Father, she says specifically she believed this was the Pope, and all the church leaders were mournfully making their way through the city, and then up a little incline to a cross, and there was a tomb at the bottom of it. And as they came up through the city toward the cross, men with guns came out and killed the Pope. At that same time, up and above, there was the angel with the flaming sword. And he says specifically, this is clearly the angel from Revelation. And the angel cries out three times, penance, penance, penance. And he says that it was the flaming sword about to destroy everything. But the Virgin Mary interposed her hand and held back the sword. And then the interpretation that the Pope has put on it, as you've heard it said, I'm sure publicly, that it was a mother's hand, guiding hand, that deflected the bullet. That's where he links it to. And that bullet has been inscribed in the statue of the Virgin Mary in Portugal. And he dedicated his pontificate to the Virgin Mary. And if we needed a greater evidence of the deviance from the Protestant norms, here is this rededication of this Romish system to the veneration of Mary right at this crucial era. Penance, penance, penance. Why did Luther begin a process that resulted in the Reformation? You know, he had the doctrine of righteousness by faith, but what was it that got him started? Remember, it was Monk Tetzel selling indulgences. Coming up to the year 2000, the Roman Catholic Church established a three-year build-up to the Jubilee year in the year 2000. It was the year of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and then the Jubilee year. For the Jubilee year, the Pope announced a general indulgence. And it wasn't just a low-level announcement. Whether or not you've heard about it, I don't know. But it was big time. This was not the Tetzel variety where you get 5,000-10,000 years off purgatory or whatever. This was general, a free pass to heaven if you satisfied the terms of the Jubilee year, and included going to Rome and so on. And I listened to Catholic shortwave radio stations with a straight face explaining the church has a store of merit that it can hand out. And yes, it can get some people straight from here to heaven. A plenary indulgence. And it seems to me this is a gift to discerning Protestants in this era, when there is such uncertainty as the role of the papacy here. In these latter days, the revitalized papacy has reverted to the age-old errors that caused Protestantism. Reiteration of indulgences, reiteration of the infallibility that it withholds to itself. It's amazing, the veneration of images, the veneration of Mary. No biblical standard for that whatsoever. We're living through an interesting revitalization of a power that was predicted, but who would ever know that it would be so open? So open. Going back to, nearly had a quote that I wanted to share, but I'll go straight to Ellen White. Liberty of conscience threatened in the great controversy, Ellen White says this: the Roman Church now presents a fair front to the world, covering with apologies her record of horrible cruelties. She has clothed herself in Christ-like garments, but she is unchanged. The papacy is just what prophecy declared she would be, the apostasy of the latter times. And she's quoting 2 Thessalonians 2, 3 and 4. It is part of her policy to assume the character which will best accomplish her purpose. But underneath the variable appearance of the chameleon, she conceals the invariable venom of the serpent. And she says, shall this power, whose record for 1,000 years is written in the blood of the saints, be now acknowledged as part of the Church of Christ? It is not without reason, and this is the payoff to what I've been saying, it is not without reason that the claim has been put forth in Protestant countries that Catholicism differs far less widely from Protestantism than in former times. There has been a change, but the change is not in the papacy. Catholicism indeed resembles much of the Protestantism that now exists, because Protestantism has so greatly degenerated since the days of the Reformers. And it's an amazement to me that this priest scandal that before the present scandal seemed to convulse the Catholic organization in North America and impress everyone else, was absorbed and passed over. Again, there's another wake-up call to people to see that this is a pernicious system that is opposing even the natural order of human relationships. It's a pernicious system. It is not without reason, she says, the claim is being put forth. Protestantism has changed in the way it views these beliefs. And I think Ellen White is right on the money when she predicted that the sympathy would develop between this resurgent Rome and Protestantism, and once the sympathy's developed, it's Protestantism that forges ahead to then push on the United States and then the rest of the world the age-old principles of error that the papacy had so exemplified. We're living through that day. When I was in Australia in the 70s, I witnessed something that I think was a dry run. Several churches united under the auspices of what's now the Uniting Church, and I really couldn't tell you which organizations, but there were about four different and discrete Protestant organizations or denominations that united. And for about a year we had a progression of church leaders, Catholic and Protestant, coming from overseas. There was the head of the World Council of Churches, there was the Archbishop of Canterbury, there were Catholic cardinals came out, they were interviewed, there were educational programs on TV, all rewriting church history, all starting from Jesus and the disciples and tracing the history down to when the Church of Rome emerged and then Protestantism separated, and always pushing the line based on a wonderfully spiritually expressed sentiment that we are all one in the body of Christ, and the body of Christ split and now it must come together. And there's a certain appeal to that in anyone that loves the truth of God and doesn't want dissension. that the body of Christ split because there were differences, there were denials of faith. People tend to forget that. And it was amazing to me to see this, the history being rewritten. And it came to a head, I remember, on one visit from the then Archbishop of Canterbury. And he sat down with an interviewer and explained how unification was really the necessary end, because we needed to give a united front against secularists and to show that the church is the body of Christ. And he said, you must understand, he says, unity happens on two levels. He says, the theologians, they like to debate these issues, you know, they argue about these fine points of a text and all the rest. He says, you know, that's their thing. But he says, the real unity happens at the church level. He says, where the congregations get together, and this was in Australia with more of an English mentality, he says, they get together for afternoon tea, and they sort of socialize and have a good time. And he says, that's what union is all about. He says, you have doctrinal differences. He says, put them away. You know, we'll discuss them later. He says, but let's join in the body of Christ and be one. And the interviewer had the moxie in Australia to say, but you know, what if such a group joins and then after they join, they can't resolve the doctrinal differences? And I'll never forget his response. It was amazing. This fellow that generally had a very kindly demeanor, he says, it's like when you have a diseased part of the body. He says, it must be cut off and destroyed. And I think that's the natural end for this sort of logic, because it's premised on some of the punitive measures that have been put in practice from the Middle Ages on forward, and they're being resurrected. They're being resurrected. What are we to do in a time like this? I believe it's important to speak to the situation, not to dodge around it. It's not, you know, I'm speaking plainly here. I don't think it's politic or very profitable to put signs like Paisley's message on a billboard saying, you know, the Pope is the Antichrist. I hardly think that's going to convert too many people. But we should, as it's appropriate, make it clear that we have a clear understanding of the nature of this religious compromise that has continued from an ancient heresy. And I think we need to be very definitive about what we're saying. There's been a lot of discussion of late about how we reach out to other groups like Muslims, for example. And we're in danger of developing an approach that shies away from real differences. And if in dealing with the resurgent Catholic Church, we think it is off the table to talk about history. They've tried to take it off the table. I think it as great controversy points it out, the story of the Reformation, the story of the excesses that led to it, and now the reinstatement of those excesses is valid to the point. And I think we will have no efficacy against such a belief system unless we tackle its religious and philosophical underpinnings. Doesn't mean you attack the people, but we have to be very specific. And the analogy I was trying to draw is the same with Islam. Does anybody at this particular point in history think that we will convert Muslims or make inroads into Islam by emphasizing just a certain commonality? There are gross and major differences that are very similar to the Catholic Church, where both of these systems own someone lock, stock and barrel. They're born into it. They don't choose to be in it. And in a society where that whole country is made up of such a belief, whether it's Islam or Catholicism, it can be social suicide for a person to try to break free from it. You don't pull those people across to a true biblical understanding of truth and of Christ just by saying, well, we have... maybe we don't eat meat, or you know, yes, we do think that you need a day of rest and so on. Got to make it very plain that their claim is inappropriate and what is the truth. And I think over the years, the Seventh-day Adventist Church has had significant success in explaining some of these problems with the Roman Catholic Church, and people have become Adventists. I think we will or should have similar success with Islam if we apply such a method. But it is not appropriate, never a very good line of attack, whether you're dealing with church operations or projecting a political view or even just explaining some club or group of people. if you do not explain what you stand for, if you're just sort of emphasizing the commonalities, people don't join a group that doesn't stand for anything. There's no point of reference. And the point of reference for Seventh-day Adventists, I believe, must remain the Reformation. We are reformers. We are the Elijah message, to go back to the last thing. And we have to have present truth. And present truth is definitively a resurgent Rome, a compromised Protestantism in this country, and the distinct danger, as Ellen White says, of the rekindling of the fires of persecution.
You've been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2004, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. For additional cassettes or CDs by this speaker, or for a free catalog of other American Cassette Ministries resources, please contact us as follows. Visit our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our entire catalog is online, plus thousands of other selections to choose from. We accept Visa, MasterCard, and Discover credit cards. Our email address is info@americancassette.org. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 800-233-4450. For international orders, dial 717-652-7000. For fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. Or you may simply write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108, in the United States of America. Maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages for 29 years, American Cassette Ministries requests your continued prayers and financial support as we strive to provide you with the finest, most powerful spiritual messages available. Our one purpose in ministry? To prepare you and your loved ones to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.